Hello, everyone. This is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. May I say quickly, for those of you who subscribe to my messages, you will know that I have been on a week's vacation, and I just wanted to let you know that it was very enjoyable and an extremely nice break, but I am glad to be back. And with it comes my guest, Michael Clarkson, who is an award-winning investigative reporter and best-selling author, a Pulitzer Prize-nominated author at that, and he's written another book with an intriguing look at what he calls, I guess, a creepy and compelling subject. And his book is called Poltergeist Phenomenon, and I think that says it all, doesn't it? Welcome to the program, Michael.
Thanks, Mike. Where did you go on your holiday?
I went to the beautiful county of Devon, which I go to twice every year to see my two sons, who just by chance both live in Devon, and my one grandchild, which is my granddaughter. So I actually go in and around an area called Newton Abbot, which you, being a Limey, or were a Limey, will know about.
Sure. Well, that's my patronizing part of the show. Let's go. Let's get on with it.
Yes, you've made a friend of me already. Now, I have to think that with your interest in this type of subject, and you are my first guest talking on this type of subject, that you must have had experiences, perhaps many years ago, perhaps as a very young person, which might have brought about your interest in perhaps ghosts and that sort of phenomenon. So perhaps you would tell us how it all started.
Sure. I guess, Mike, you would categorize me a bit of a skeptic, a long-time journalist, police reporter. 1980, I came across a 10-year anniversary story of a as you pronounce it, poltergeist, or as I pronounce it over here in Canada, poltergeist case, which happened in St. Catharines, Ontario, Canada, in 1970. And what intrigued me about this was that there was two entire shifts of police officers who swore they saw, for lack of a better phrase, things that go bump in the day. They were at this small apartment, and objects, furniture, chairs, paintings were moving only when this young boy was in the room. And being a skeptic, I thought, well, it seems like a nice story. But so I did a Halloween story 10 years later about it. And the young boy, who's now a 21-year-old man, came around to my house. He told me some things. And I thought, you know, this down the road might be worth a more serious look. So since 1980, I've been compiling and sort of storing poltergeist stories from the internet and from newspapers, and done quite a bit of digging on my own. And finally, one day, a couple of years ago, I sat down and started to write the book, and here we are.
Right, right. So you've had many years of experience, and in fact, I read that you've been reviewing over 75 cases of paranormal activity. So that's a fair, I suppose, number to gauge your opinions on. So what did you find generally was happening where the poltergeist were concerned? I mean, do you find that they are mainly benign, or are they actually, to use the word, even dangerous?
I suppose you could use the word semi-dangerous. There, in the 75 cases I reviewed, there were about a dozen people who had minor injuries, but I think they were more indirect as a result of flying objects. But if we've got a couple of minutes here, I'll just go into my definition and try to answer your question of some of the similarities I found. The definition I came up with, poltergeist, is a definition put forward years ago by a parapsychologist in the United States named William Roll, R-O-L-L. He's perhaps the number one authority in poltergeist. And he calls poltergeist activity RSPK for short, which stands for recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. And that means bizarre movements of objects, noises, and other paranormal effects caused unconsciously by a person. Unlike psychokinesis, which I consider a close cousin, it occurs spontaneously and reportedly over a period of time. Psychokinesis, your listeners may be more aware of, is a more controlled type of mind over matter. But getting back, Mike, to these 75 cases I reviewed, all of them involved unusual movements of objects, whether it's cups, saucers, chairs, supposedly moving on their own. In most of these cases, the activity seemed to revolve, like the St. Catherine's case, around a young person in the room. In only about 5 or 7% of the 75 cases, did it seem that a spirit was reportedly involved and perhaps acting through a young person to move objects. Even a chap called Alan Murdy, former chairman of England's Ghost Club Society, and that bills itself as the oldest oldest organization in the world devoted to psychical research, he says that in poltergeist cases, buildings are not haunted, people are, and I agree with that. I think what we're dealing with here, Mike, is with haunted people. And there are a number of common denominators I found in these 75 cases. Usually, as I say, the poltergeist agent is someone who is young and someone usually quite intelligent, above average in intelligence. There's also usually some sort of repression or frustration of the poltergeist agent or the young person by others, and a high level of stress in the household prior to the start of the poltergeist activity and continuing throughout the case. Now, these cases are usually fairly short-lived with a lifespan of perhaps a week to several months, although there have been some cases, including the famous or infamous, however you want to put it, Enfield case in London in 1977-78, which lasted about a year. And as you alluded to earlier, there's really, it's a mischievous intent, I think, on the part of the poltergeist agent rather than a downright malevolent intent. As I stated, about a dozen people have been injured, but none seriously in the cases in my book.
Right. So you haven't really come across any instances where you would say there was some deliberate intent on the part of the poltergeist to harm people with objects moving around and sometimes being thrown. Presumably, it's accidental.
Mm-hmm. Actually, there is an intent, Mike, but I think the intent, albeit subconscious, is to get attention. It's when we're usually dealing with an adolescent, not always. I have a case right now in Canada of a woman in her 40s who's allegedly got poltergeist activity. But the intent, I don't think, is to hurt someone. The intent, I think, is to get attention. I think in some cases there's such a high stress in the household, and many times we're dealing with young people who are suppressed in their household, and they feel they have no other way of expressing themselves, especially to their parents, rather than causing this incredible mind over matter.
So the evidence that I've read would suggest that where young people are concerned, and I have read often that it's associated with a stage of puberty, that they are unaware that they are the source of what is happening. Would you say that is true?
I think so. I think at some point, especially with the cases of longer duration, I think that they do become conscious that they have some extra powers. And this is what makes some of these cases suspect, including the Enfield case in London. In fact, in some of these cases, the actual poltergeist activity or paranormal activity, if you want to call it, if it is legitimate, sometimes it subsides after a couple of weeks. But the young people are getting such attention by that point, their parents, the family, perhaps media, parapsychologists come in, that they don't want to lose the attention, so that they may lose their powers, but they want to keep the attention going, so they result to trickery. In other words, suddenly the lamps and the furniture are not moving from the child's mind, and they're actually pulling it when they think no one's around. And then when they're caught, of course, the skeptics say, ha-ha, you see, I told you it was cheating all along, but I don't think things are that simple in some of these cases. In fact, I call this type of thing, including the Enfield one, the when the circus comes to town syndrome. Young people, being young people, like to get attention, and when that attention goes away, they sometimes resort to other things. When the circus, the media circus, comes to town, they want to keep attention. So they do it through trickery. But that doesn't necessarily mean we have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. That means perhaps in some of these cases we have to go back and look at the earlier evidence, and if there's strong evidence and if there are strong witnesses, then maybe we have both legitimate paranormal activity and fraud within the same case.
From my own sort of reading of such phenomenon, it seems to me that what happens is often extremely childish in the nature of it. But have you ever found any evidence that there is a high intelligence anywhere in connection with it?
As I said earlier, there seems to be, when some of these agents are tested later on, that there is a above-average intelligence. Now, to say that there's a higher rate of intelligence in actually things moving around, I don't know. Perhaps there is, and perhaps some of this evidence is that the flying objects come and go, and perhaps the young people want to see, they want these things to move when there are certain people in the room as opposed to others. But there's one very important aspect of this, Mike, I want to get into right now, and it is how they actually do it. And, of course, we're not 100% sure. Do we have a few minutes right now to talk about that?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Off you go.
Sure. I think they found that, as I say, first of all, this is a very hard subject to investigate, not only for reporters like me, but for parapsychologists, because there seems to be a lot, when there's stress involved in a household and unusual events occurring, the families often feel shame, they often feel guilt, perhaps they're part of the problem, they don't want people to know about it. So very few of these cases are actually properly investigated, but of the cases which have been investigated, they have found that many of these agents, these poltergeist kids, have unique brains. They've found a slightly higher rate of epilepsy and schizophrenia in many of these cases. In fact, there was a late parapsychologist by the name of Andrew Green who lived in London, and he said some of the agents suffered from what he called a front temporal lobe epilepsy. That's a brain disorder in which people can suffer blackouts lasting from a minute to half an hour. And during these blackouts, an unknown power of the mind may be released, which can cause objects to move. Now, we're going to get a little more into depth here. In fact, there are so many components, I think, Mike, involved in the typical case that you almost have to call it a perfect psychic storm. At one time, I was going to call my book Psychic Tantrums, but there have to be so many components, it seems, come together to make these objects move. And another one of these components is, I think, these agents with the unusual brains subconsciously tap into nearby sources of energy, usually in the room, in a building, whether it's electricity, geomagnetic storms maybe in the area, magnetic fields, or even energy from the mind-body. I think sometimes we forget that we have electricity in the beat of our heart, and we have electrical signals moving along our nerve cells, and when we walk across a carpet, of course, our bodies pick up or rub off extra electrons, and this can slightly change your body's electrical potential. And then, of course, Mike, when you touch the doorknob, then zap, you feel it. And finally, as you mentioned earlier, there's an angle about puberty, young people going through puberty, and we're not exactly sure about this, but I know that scientists and medics think that during puberty, there can be a type of sexual or creative energy which is released. So that also seems to be part of the perfect psychic storm in these cases.
Right. Now, in connection with this type of activity, has there been any evidence of what you might call ghostly or spiritual entities appearing in connection with it?
Mm-hmm. As I said earlier, I think in general the 75 cases are haunted people rather than haunted buildings or possession. However, I do have a chapter on ghosts, and there are some cases. There's a psychiatrist in Virginia, United States, by the name of Dr. Ian Stevenson. He believes there is a link between spirits of the dead and this poltergeist activity, and he sometimes suggests to victimized families that a seance be held to cleanse a home. There are others who believe that the agent is possessed by a spirit or a demon, and they sometimes suggest a type of exorcism to bring the person back to himself or herself. Now, in Edinburgh, Scotland, not that long ago, maybe 10 years ago, I know there was a case. It was a Reverend Colin Grant. He conducted an exorcism in the historic Greyfriars Churchyard. And after numerous reports of haunting and poltergeist-like occurrences, but the instance reportedly continues to this day. I mentioned earlier William Roll, the parapsychologist in Georgia who studied hundreds and hundreds of poltergeist cases. He does not know of any case in which a spirit was responsible for a poltergeist incident. However, I quote him, he said, "We should not close our minds to that possibility, but they always seem to occur around a living person." I can actually give you a case or two here, a ghost-related case, if we have time.
Absolutely, yes, carry on. Yes.
Okay. Not yes, that long ago, less than 2 years ago in Cork City, Ireland, there was a family which abandoned their three-bedroom house. Now, they had reported occurrences over several weeks, which they blamed on evil spirits. There were flying ashtrays, glasses, flying screams in the night, orbs hovering in the air, a cooker reportedly turning itself off and on, cushions flipping over on a chair, and a young boy was tossed out of bed, reportedly. Now, they brought in two priests who celebrated masses at the home, and a shaman, a religious man by the name of Paul O'Halloran. He led an exorcism, but the occurrences continued. O'Halloran believed that three restless ghosts were caught in a time warp and haunting the property. And to quote him, he said, "The reason they are making so much noise is they want the issue to be sorted out and they want to be freed. I feel the energy is an angry one and needs to be moved on." But these, at least in the cases I've reviewed, seem to be in the minority. I can read you, if you want, a more typical case of the haunted people.
Yeah, please do. Carry on.
Sure. I alluded earlier to the St. Catherine, Ontario case in 1970. This was, to my mind, one of the most well-documented cases, although not nearly as highly publicized as, let's say, the Enfield case in 1977-78. But in the St. Catherine's case, what really got my attention in this was, as I said, I was a police reporter, and I found so many cops who were willing to put their names on a report saying they think they saw poltergeist activity. And as you and I know, police have a lot to lose in terms of credibility, going back to the police station and signing a report in front of the sergeant saying they saw a ghost or they saw a poltergeist. So
right.
When cops talk about these things, I think their testimony carries more weight than the average person. I know when you have an automobile accident, you'll get five witnesses and sometimes five different stories. But police officers are also trained to view action when it's happening fast. They're also trained to be quite skeptical. And when there's a person around whom the activity revolves in a room, I think they start to become suspicious of this person. But in the St. Catherine's case, over a two-week period, these two shifts of police officers, not one of them reported seeing this boy. It was revolving around an 11-year-old boy. We'll call him John Barber. No one reported seeing him do any trickery. And, in fact, I'll read you a couple of little logs here from the St. Catharines Police logbook. Friday, February 7th, 10 p.m., Constable Robert Crawford found a heavy bed had reportedly been raised 2 feet off the floor in an apartment by an unseen force. It was reported by a Mrs. Baines, a neighbor who told police she had seen it rise off the floor in the bedroom of the 11-year-old boy, John Barber. Crawford rushed into the room and saw the bed raising approximately 2 feet off the floor, unsupported. "Not believing my eyes," he said, "I summoned another officer who was outside the apartment, and he, too, saw the bed rise up off the floor." 3 days later, February 10th, for about the 12th time in almost 2 weeks, Constable Bill Weir said he saw John Barber, the young boy, thrown off a chair. Weir wrote in his report, quote, "I attended in the morning and was assisted by Constable Eddie Batarski. While I was there, I witnessed some phenomenal occurrences which I have attached to this report. At 9 p.m., I proceeded to the residence again with Constable Crawford, where we again witnessed some very unusual things taking place. Between the time of the two calls, I contacted Mr. Bradley, the city building inspector. We both agreed that the causes of these weird occurrences was that the boy was at the center of poltergeist activity. Now, Constable Weir's report was later signed and authorized by his commanding officer. But what Weir did not put in his report, Mike, was he said he also got the treatment from this unseen force. Weir told Constable Harry Fox that the poltergeist force picked up a chair that the 250-pound Weir was sitting in and tipped him on his ass. Now, if this little John Barber, all 75 pounds soaking wet of him, had really done that physically, Mike, I think that would be a tough one to explain to the boys back at the police station.
Yeah, indeed.
So that is really what got me going in this. And as I followed these cases, I found in 17 cases since 1952, at least 51 police officers claimed to have seen this poltergeist activity up close, and more than a dozen of them say they had minor assaults, and in fact they were hit by flying objects, but none was seriously injured, and as far as I know, a poltergeist has never been charged.
Right. Now, you have said that in the main they don't appear to be dangerous or deliberately dangerous, but has there ever been an instance of whether where they played with fire, for example?
There have been some isolated courses of fire. In fact, there's some evidence to suggest that poltergeist agent can create fires through spontaneous combustion. There is a professor in, of all places, Moscow, Russia. His name was Professor Andrei Lee. He heads an emergency poltergeist service, and he's investigated more than one fire. He says in these cases, fires often stop after a few weeks, and the activity in those cases is sometimes replaced by moving objects. As another follow-up to your fire question, there was in 1983 in Formia, Italy, it was said that mysterious fire started in the presence of a 10-year-old boy burning books and wood furniture and scorching plastic. Reportedly, he also caused electromagnetic effects on machines and motors. It was said that a parapsychologist by the name of Demetrio Croce worked with a boy to try to teach him how to channel his powers, but the results are not known, and as I said earlier, unfortunately, There's not too many follow-ups in some of these cases for a number of reasons. Often the family doesn't want to be known. In fact, in the St. Catherine's case, John Barber I gave you was a pseudonym. He came to my house 10 years later, and his name still had not crept into the newspapers. And the family was so paranoid about anyone finding out. When they saw my anniversary story 10 years later, even though I had not named the boy, they kicked him out of the house. He's 21 years old. It was Halloween. He had nowhere to go. Where did he come? He came to my house to share his frustration of how he was not even allowed to speak about it 10 years after the fact. And it was very frustrating to him because he was working with young people, and he did not want this to get out. He felt if the parents of the young people found out he had been involved in a poltergeist case 10 years earlier, that they would take their children away from him. So, as you can see, there's a certain stigma involved in all of this, and it affects things. It affects things such as people's open-mindedness, willingness to embrace the paranormal. It affects things like government grants. Government grants can suddenly dry up when scientists are found to be investigating the paranormal. It's the stigma's even affected me. I knew as an investigator, a police reporter, writing suddenly a book about the paranormal, I would come under attack, and sure enough, I have already. My credibility has been questioned by some people, but that's part of the game, I think, and if we want to try to get ahead on this, to learn something, I think we have to take chances, and that's what I've done.
I agree. Now, I notice that you have mentioned the Amityville horror. Do you put that in the same category? Because some of the things that happened there were, say, like the flies, the masses of flies that appeared, wouldn't be, I would guess, called poltergeist activity. What do you think about that one?
I'm very skeptical. I was skeptical to begin with, but in that particular case, and almost all other cases which are attached to movies, I'm extremely skeptical. In fact, I can really find no case similar to my 75 cases I reviewed, which went to the big screen, went to TV, which Hollywood didn't get a hold of, which were actually based on fact. I think the closest one would have been William Blatty's 1971 book, The Exorcist, which was a bestseller, and then was made into a movie in 1973. And I think there was some basis to that. I think it was partly based on a poltergeist case in Maryland. But again, once the screenwriters get a hold of these things, particularly I think in the case of the Amityville Horror, I don't think there's a heck of a lot left as far as science goes. But they're entertaining, and don't get me wrong. I like the movies, series of movies, the poltergeist, there was several of them, but poltergeist coming through TV screens, I can't buy that.
Right. Now, I gather that you carried out some research into Randy. Now, I don't know a lot about this person, but if my memory serves me correctly, is he the one who is very skeptical about all this sort of phenomenon? And if you looked into it, what was your opinion of his findings?
Yeah, you're right, Mike. Well, he used to be a skeptic. Now he's a cynic. He's a professional cynic. Right. He just, he wouldn't, I could hardly even get a word out of him from my book. I tried to explain to him that I was a serious investigator. I have these cases. Would you talk to me about it? But Randy, I think in the beginning, and he's got a lot of ammunition. The cases I mentioned earlier, some of them seem to be some fraud involved. I know there's a lot of frauds out there. A lot of people who fake things. Obviously, on these days on YouTube and the internet, it's very easy to come up with your own Hollywood special effects and make it look like you've seen a ghost. But in the beginning, I think Randy was good for this whole debate. He was skeptical, but now unless he's seen it himself, he doesn't believe it. He's got this $1 million challenge. If anyone can prove the existence of any paranormal event, he says he's willing to give them $1 million. But I think his criteria is very strict for that. I've come across him in a couple of cases, one particularly in Columbus, Ohio in 1984, in which there was a telephone flew across the room while a girl was holding it, among other things, objects moving. And the Amazing Randy showed up, but he said that the case was a fraud before he even got into the house, before he even talked to anyone. So really, I almost have to dismiss Randy, because unless you go into these things with at least a little bit of a crack of an open mind, then how are we going to further the conversation? You know, he shows up in a cape. It's a lot about entertainment. And, of course, then when he heard that this young girl with a moving phone eventually did pull something down when the TV, she thought the TV cameras had left, but the TV camera caught her pulling something down, then he's one of these chaps who says, aha, see, I told you it was all a fraud. But, again, I'm not ready, like the Amazing Randy, to throw the baby out with the bathwater, and I think we do quite a disservice to what I think is a very unusual phenomenon if we just dismiss it outright.
You've spoken about Uri Geller. Was he one of the people that Randy had problems with? Because I think you have a different point of view there.
Well, Geller, again, I think with Geller, he may have some abilities as far as he's known for spoon bending, of course, bending spoons with his mind. Now, he, I guess, came under some discredit when he went on American TV shows. I believe he went on Johnny Carson's show, and he couldn't make, do the psychokinesis or mind over matter when the camera was on. But I think we find that from time to time, not all people who have psychokinesis, not even all great athletes, can perform under pressure all the time. Many people choke under pressure, but yes, Geller, of course, billed himself as a psychic, and his career really peaked probably about 40 years ago. He said he discovered psychic powers when he was 5, and he said he saw a blue spark coming from his mother's sewing machine, and when he tried to touch it, he reportedly received a severe shock and was knocked off his feet, and after that, he said he was able to read his mother's mind and could make the hand speed up on a watch by focusing on it. There seems to be a bit of a correlation there between what I described earlier of these poltergeist agents tapping into electrical sources which are nearby, so I'm not going to throw that one out. Now, Geller was studied at the Stanford Research Institute, which was quite highly respected in the 1970s, and apparently he impressed scientists by correctly identifying numbers he couldn't see, although tests to prove his metal bending abilities were inconclusive, and that's another problem with this type of stuff, Mike, is that it's hard, very hard, to come up with conclusive evidence. In fact, there's been some respected laboratories who've conducted the evidence, and it's not always conclusive. It seems to be that these people are hit and miss in their mind powers.
Well, I think on the very subject of spoon bending, in the period of time that Uri Geller got a lot of publicity, he was actually able to show that many young people could do the same thing. So it wasn't a unique phenomenon just to Uri Geller, was it?
No, and I'm going to quote someone else. I'm going to bring us up maybe 20 years later to late 80s, and the famous fiction author by the name of Michael Crichton. He was also a medical doctor, and he talked about his successful experience with psychokinesis at spoon bending party. And I'm going to, I've got a couple minutes here. I'll read you some of his observations from his 1988 book by the name of Travels.
Yes.
He said, "I bent a spoon and I knew it wasn't a trick. I looked around the room and saw little children, 8 or 9 years old, bending large metal bars." Mm. He also says, "Spoon bending obviously must have some ordinary explanation since 100 people from all walks of life were doing it. And it was hard to feel any sort of mystery. You just rub the spoon for a while, and pretty soon it gets soft and it bends, and that's that. The only thing I noticed is that spoon bending seemed to require a focused inattention. You had to try to get it to bend, and then you had to forget about it. Maybe talk to someone else while you rub the spoon or look around the room. Change your attention. That is when it was likely to bend." And finally, he said, "This seems to me to confirm the idea that so-called psychic or paranormal phenomena are actually misnamed. There's nothing abnormal about them. On the contrary, they're utterly normal. We've just forgotten we can do them. The minute we do them, we recognize them for what they are, and we think to ourselves, so what?" So I thought that was a pretty good way of putting it.
Yes, absolutely. Just thinking back to the objects that are associated with poltergeist. Mm-hmm. Has there been instances of where objects have appeared that have actually been proven to come from somewhere else totally different?
It's possible, Mike. However, not in the cases I reviewed. As I said, I had a fairly strict definition which I had to follow when I was gathering these 75 cases, and many of them did involve William Rohl and his interpretation of RSPK. So there may be some other cases which fit the description you just mentioned, which we may have to give some other definition to, whether it's poltergeist, whether it's ghosts, whether it's possession, whether it's related to UFO, I don't know. I mean, there's obviously things, a lot of things we don't know. In fact, I'm not saying I can prove poltergeist exists. I'm not sure if anyone can prove it. I'm just bringing a lot of evidence forward, which I think is very suggestive.
Hmm. Incidentally, just as a small point here, what is the meaning of polter? I mean, geist means ghost, doesn't it?
I'm not sure. Poltergeist is, the definition of poltergeist from Germany was noisy ghost. So
noisy
I
ghost.
Guess that's what it means.
Oh, right, yes.
So that's actually one definition what's held up over the years. In fact, throughout history, even before William Rohl came along and sort of refined this about 50 years ago, from ancient times too, as you referred to the Andeville Horror case, there have been so-called noisy ghosts. And an argument could be made that because they're reported from all different parts of the globe, and because the dynamics of each case seem to be relatively similar, that unless there's some collusion among the people getting together with their stories, I guess this might be some evidence to suggest that poltergeists exist because they've been reported throughout history, and they all seem to have the same circumstances.
Yes. Now, if we could sort of progress your ideas forward a little bit here, if people believe that after people die, they become spiritual beings that can return, even if we can't see them. I've read stories where they've evidently tried to make themselves known by moving objects or doing things to get attention. Now, have you found any instances where that would be more likely an explanation?
It's possible. I'm going to give you a case here now, and it's not necessarily about moving objects, but it's a little bit different. It was in Manchester, England, 1995, and a family by the name of Gardner involved were reportedly a young woman and a ghost. But water was found seeping throughout the house, not things moving. Water was seeping throughout the house, and the family said that they sometimes heard unexplained coughing and the smell of licorice, similar to the flavor of flavored cigarette paper. Now, there is a parapsychologist in Manchester by the name of Stephen Mera, M-E-R-A. He investigated the case, and he says he was hit in the back by an unknown force while he was investigating this case, and it left welts in his back. He also reported there was a sweet smell of pipe tobacco in the air. And after investigating, Mera found out that a man who had died in the house used to smoke a pipe. Now, they brought in a Roman Catholic church vicar, and he conducted a blessing of the home, and he believed that poltergeist activity was focusing on the young daughter and the granddaughter in the family. Now, the family moved to another home to try to move away from these incidents, and the mysterious water pourings apparently followed them. And Stephen Mera wrapped up the case by wondering, was it a case of the family being plagued by poltergeist, or was Mrs. Gardner haunted by her late husband, perhaps angry that she had remarried? And he said we might never know. So as you can see there are allusions to cases of people who have died, and perhaps in one manner or another, they try to get the attention of the living people.
Right. Now, there is a case that has been documented and shown on television, which I'm sure you will be aware of. I don't know the name of it, but it was about this workshop where pebbles used to keep coming down from apparently nowhere. Are you familiar with the one I'm talking about?
I don't think so. Was this in the UK?
Yes.
I'm not familiar with that case. I may have come across it and not thought it was worthy of a full-scale look. In other words, there may have not been enough information about it for me to review.
Right.
I've heard of the Enfield case had reportedly falling stones. Now, is this what you... this had nothing to do with the workshop, but near the end of the Enfield case, there were reportedly, outside the house, there were stones or pebbles falling from the sky. I'm not sure if that's what you're referring to.
No. In this one, pebbles used to get thrown across the workshop, and of course, no one saw it being done. But suddenly, there was a sort of a noise, and you realised one had been thrown from somewhere else. And I think they, at one stage, were also thrown onto the roof. But be that as it may, I just wondered whether you'd come across that one, because this went on for quite a long time, you know, over a period of quite a long number of days. And you've mentioned, of course, that most of them are relatively short.
Yeah. There was, I can read you a similar case, if you want, about, it was almost like a workshop deal in 1973, it was actually in Toronto, Canada. There were eight members of a Toronto Society of Psychical Research. They actually tried to conjure up a ghost, a poltergeist-type ghost, using their minds. Do you want me to go into that case a little bit?
Yes, please do, yes.
Sure. actually, they tried to conjure up the ghost. Instead, they reported that they actually summoned poltergeist activity. Now, this was led by a doctor, a psychic researcher by the name of A.R.G. Owen, O-W-E-N, and a member of the Department of Preventive Medicine and Biostatics at the University of Toronto. So these were respected individuals. They came up with an imaginary dead person, and they called him Philip. In fact, this became known as the Philip Experiment. Then they held a seance for this imaginary Philip. But instead of bringing out an apparition, they reportedly produced rapping sounds, flickering lights, and they actually made a table move and flip over. They recorded the sounds, and the speculation was that the members had created a type of group consciousness, or perhaps even a group hallucination. They had suggestions for others considering their own experiments, and here they are. Use at least four people who have a good rapport with one another and a common motivation. Mm-hmm. Be open-minded. Agree on details and the history of the imaginary person. Make him or her a friendly entity. Suspend your disbelief during the sessions and expect a miracle. Be patient and enthusiastic. So maybe we can try that one night, Mike.
Yes. Right. Now, you also have had lots of experiences, either directly or with people that have experienced a lot of fear. And I believe one of your claims to fame is that you know how to handle stress and fear that arises from this type of experience. Tell us a little bit about your beliefs there and how you handle fear.
I think I can handle it better than I used to. I don't think I handle fear properly every time. I think most people actually choke under fearful or pressure situations. Even Tiger Woods in his heyday, he has worse Sunday scores than earlier in the week in a golf tournament. I think when we get pressured, when we feel fear, we generally tend to act a little worse than we do without fear. However, yes, after many years of deadline pressure, many years of playing soccer and basketball, I've come up with a formula. When I feel I'm choking, I found out that when you choke, you get too much adrenaline in your system, and it tends to make you freeze. And I think what we need when we're under pressure is a more proactive mix of hormones for our fight-or-flight system. That's what we're dealing with here when we fear fearful, Mike. Our fight-or-flight system kicks in. Everyone has it. We turn into different people. Our adrenaline and dopamine and testosterone all come into play to help us try to survive what we think is a threatening situation. So what I found works for me is that when I fear that I'm choking under pressure, I'll give you an example. I was covering a big sports event in Los Angeles, and the Toronto Star, my newspaper, had sent me thousands of miles, paid a lot of money for me to go there. And I found that under deadline I was choking under pressure. I felt myself shaking. I wasn't going to get the story finished. And I got angry with myself. And when I got angry with myself, it seemed very briefly to get me going and get me out of the fearful stage, and I was able to actually perform better under pressure, and I seemed to have more time than normal. But the key thing in this formula is to change your fear briefly to anger or to a joyful response, something to get you out of the fear more. But then, because you're putting testosterone and dopamine into your system when you get angry, as we know, anger can blow up in your face, and you can only keep it in your system so long. But the third and most important part of this formula is dispassionately putting all these hormones into whatever it is you're doing, whether it was me typing and interviewing people under pressure of deadline, whether it's a soccer player, Wayne Rooney, taking a penalty kick and not slipping like he did a couple of weeks ago, whether it's, say, a Wall Street tycoon with a big deal coming up. You've got to put these hormones, you've got to put your focus into whatever it is you're doing. And when you do that, you can you have these mental abilities which you don't have without pressure, because your testosterone and your dopamine are actually making you focus better. In fact, you can go into a mode which I call tachypsychia. It's Greek for speed of the mind. You hear this all the time from police and gun battles, from people in automobile accidents, even from athletes in the World Cup final. Things seem to happen in slow motion. And just hold on for a sec. what happens is it seems like things are going in slow motion, but your mind is actually giving you more time to react. It's like a video camera on fast forward. You're getting the frame one action at a time. That's why athletes say, you know, the final games seem to happen in slow motion, but things are not happening in slow motion. It's just your fight-or-flight system, your tachypsychia, is giving you this action so that you will have more, seemingly more time to react. And I've had a number of occurrences like this in sports, and usually it involves my ego. I'm not defending myself physically as much as I'm defending my ego. And when I feel my ego is threatened, then I tend to sometimes go into fight or flight. And when I feel this fight or flight coming on, then I go into this formula I just mentioned. Fear to anger to, in the end, dispassionate response. So if there are some of your listeners out there who are in high-pressure situations, high-pressure jobs, perhaps they can try to use this. It didn't happen for me overnight. But I've been able to use this on a fairly regular basis when I feel I'm under pressure. And I think the big picture is, Mike, I think that there are many parts of our mind, obviously, that we don't use or that we don't know how to use. And part of this is, again, stigma. We don't want to admit that we have paranormal experiences so that then we don't get to develop them.
Are the responses you're talking about there similar to an occasion when, say, I'll give you an example of something that really happened, where someone got trapped under a car and there was only this one person around and he believed that he could lift that car off that person? Now, normally he wouldn't be able to do that, but in that moment of whatever emotions or fear that he felt, he actually found this super strength and was able to do it. Now, is it similar to that?
It's exactly the same. There's no difference. The only difference is that what I described were mental powers, but the fight-or-flight system was made for what you described, physical powers. In fact, scientists tell me that we're going to have this caveman response, this fight-or-flight, this physical response to danger, for another 100,000 years. So I think we're going to have to adapt it to our modern society. And what I described is a type of adapting. We've got this caveman body, this Black and Decker body, which responds to threats the way cavemen did a million years ago. But now we've got this computer brain, and now many of our threats are social, they're professional, and when we feel really stressed out, our fight-or-flight system kicks in the same way it would if we were faced with a physical threat, and it doesn't know the difference. So it's up to our brain to filter what the threat is and to give it some interpretation so that we're not blowing up all the time. I think some people are, maybe they're hardwired into their fight-or-flight system a little more sensitively than others, and of course we call these people type A's. But no, what you described is exactly right, and I investigated many of those cases. There was an investigative case of a woman in Glacier National Park in the United States who beat up this grizzly bear who was attacking her husband. Well, she went into fight or flight and beat off this grizzly bear with a pair of binoculars. And yes, I've had cases of little old ladies picking up cars off their grandchildren. They didn't. It's not a thing where you think about it. It's just a knee-jerk reaction, and everyone has this ability. But in the case you described, perhaps maybe only once in a lifetime.
Oh, yeah, yes. So what you're saying, I guess, is that you do something without giving any thought. You don't say to yourself, I couldn't possibly do that. Just in that split second, you don't give it a thought. You just go and do it, and it happens.
Yes. But when I described that formula earlier, there's also the non-thinking aspect component to that as well. I thought for many years, how am I going to do this? What's my formula going to be? How am I going to change this to dispassionate response? Well, the dispassionate response is not thinking. I've had a number of incidents, incredible games in sports where my fight-or-flight system was involved, but I didn't think about it. I didn't realize what had happened until 2 or 3 days later, and I backtracked and I thought, oh, my God, what happened there? Well, at the time, I wasn't thinking about it. I let my training kick in. And once you start overthinking things, once your mind gets in the way of these things, then it's not natural. It's like Michael Crichton said about the spoon bending. Once you think about things too much, then you start to get in your own way and it doesn't work.
Interesting. Well, you certainly know your subject very well, and I'm sure your book will provoke a lot of interest. At this point, because we haven't got very much time left, would you like to give our listeners your website address and tell them where they can get your book from?
Sure. They can get it from Amazon.com or from my publisher in New Jersey, New Page Books, www.newpagebooks.com, or they can write me at michael.paul.clarkson@gmail.com.
Okay. Right, you've given me your website, you've given me your email address, and the one that you said where they could get the books other than Amazon, was that the New Page Books?
That's two things. Newpagebooks.com is my publisher, or on the internet, the bookselling site, Amazon.com.
All right, okay, fine. Just to like that, to get that one clear. We've got a couple of minutes left. Is there anything you would like to add to what we've already discussed? I mean, is there any aspect of it that we might have overlooked? Or?
Got a couple of minutes?
Yes, a couple of minutes, yes.
Help for the victim. Sometimes in these cases, people are confused, they're angry, they're hurt, they don't know what to do, there's poltergeist activity going on. So you ask yourself how to get rid of an alleged poltergeist, but most cases, I say, of RSPK seem to die a natural death. Sometimes, Mike, these occurrences end when the agent realizes he or she is the cause. Other times, psychotherapy seems to help. As I mentioned, exorcisms don't seem to work. However, clergy and parapsychologists report some relief to the victims when they counsel a family. And if the stress in the family is addressed, often the paranormal activity will disappear. In one case, there was a case in Baltimore, U.S., where a young person was causing poltergeist activity because he felt his talent was being suppressed and his parents weren't paying attention to him. I think he was an artist and a painter. And the parapsychologist suggested to the parents that they give him encouragement for his talent, for his writing ability, and they agreed. And when they did that, the stress in the household seemed to dissipate, and voila, the poltergeist activity also dissipated. So often it can be a negative thing, but it can dissipate. And what we talked about, the fight or flight, I think that's a little bit different, and it's a way to channel it. But it's you have to be very careful with these things.
Right. Well, I have to say thank you very much, Michael. It's been an extremely interesting interview with you, and it's one of those subjects, I guess, that people don't know too much about. So I hope that will result in a few book sales for you. So thank you very much, Michael.
Good questions. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Well, friends, next week, subject to confirmation, I will have an author named Aaron Kaplan. He's written a book called Deep Analysis, Frightening Conclusion, and it's another look, yet again, at the Roswell incident. So he reckons he's found a lot of new information. So I hope you can join me next week. And thank you for being with me today. God bless you all. Thank you.